cliffcentral.com. The Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. Good afternoon. You're live with us on the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. My name is Kingsley Kipuya. I'll be the person guiding you through this journey for the next hour. Greg Nicholson, how are you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
Oh, good. You still have that January optimism, or was it fading away like the rest of us? The eating plans, the gym plans, the new year, new me feeling.
I was thinking, I haven't gone to the gym yet.
Okay, so you never had.
I haven't been eating well, so I don't think I've been the most optimistic
man,
person
be said
since
for
2017.
There's a lot to be said for consistency, man. You don't want to rock the boat too much. Just, you know, if it's working, keep doing it.
But I'll start hitting the weight soon. I'll keep you updated.
That's it. For everybody listening in, thank you for tuning in. Firstly, before we get into it, we get a lot of sort of informal feedback on Twitter around, you know, ideas for future shows and feedback on shows. And we just wanted to sort of do a call out of saying, you know, we love that and we'd love to formalize it. So if you have any ideas for future shows that you'd like us to cover, specific topics that you think we should dig into, or if you're working on something at your office, at your place of work, and you say, you know what, this is worthy of attention, please send us an email on
greg@dailymaverick.co.za.
Absolutely. So any feedback, comments, questions, or just input for future shows, please let us know. Now, to this week's show, we've got a packed one. Firstly, talking about President Donald Trump, just over a week in office, and we're going to be looking at his executive orders. So what are the ones we actually need to be paying attention to? Is it the ones that are the most grabbing the most press? Are there specific ones that need to go through, you know, Congress and the Senate first before becoming, you know, fully binding and what's going on there? Secondly, we'll be talking about, you know, continental matters, specifically the election of a new African Union Commission chair yesterday evening. And finally, we'll be looking at local politics. So the ANC, NEC had Lekotla last week. Greg Nicholson was covering that, and we'll jump into that. So first, Donald Trump. We've got Brooks Spector on the line to be talking to us about this. Now, Brooks, I mean, just to get started, I mean, I've been trying to get a sense of when
Hello.
Hi, can you hear us, Brooks? Hello, Brooks? I think we're having a technical issue with our Skype line. We're just going to dig into that. Anyway, Greg, while we get Brooks on, we were just looking at this article from the Washington Post that we'll tweet shortly. And it was basically listing Trump's executive orders and saying what has a few more obstacles. So what needs to go through either a formal proposal, what needs to go through the House, what needs to go through the Senate before it's a law, and what is it sufficient to have an executive order, and that simple. And basically what comes out of this is that specifically the suspension of immigration, that's the 90-day ban, that's fully binding with an executive order, at least for the 90 days. Second was the abandonment of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, right? So there's a 12-nation agreement, largely with Asian countries, but that Obama's administration worked on for about, you know, his whole 10 years president. And that's been abandoned. Donald Trump said he wants to have specific, you know, agreements with the specific countries. And thirdly, is the Keystone XL pipeline. So you'll remember that we covered this. There were a lot of protests around the pipeline, one going through, I think it was North Dakota, and there was a lot of, you know, turbulence around that. And that needs only the State Department approval. So I think at the very least, what this tells me is that whole sentiment that there was a lot of times during his campaign where Donald Trump was saying a lot of things and we don't know how much of it would actually do is, you know, he's being very clear that a lot of the things he said he intended on doing. So, Greg, I mean, watching this, I mean, specifically just on Twitter and watching on CNN, there seems to be specifically around the travel ban, there was a very immediate, very large reaction to people arriving at airports, either in America or across the world, and being told that they could not enter the United States of America. Some of these people who had legally applied for green cards, some of these people who had been helping U.S. efforts in places like Iraq and Iran, people who've been translators, people who've literally furthering America's military interest in all these countries, and they simply couldn't go back. Were you surprised by the protests we saw, for example, at JFK Airport, at LAX Airport, a lot of these places of people saying, no, this is not okay? Did that surprise you? Or do you think that, you know, something like this, you know, we would expect a reaction like that?
No, I don't think that's surprising at all that we saw widespread protests at a number of these airports, because obviously Trump had been using strong rhetoric against foreigners throughout the election campaign. And some of these, I think some of the actions he's taking now through these executive orders were to be expected, but I think to have it enacted in such a dramatic and such a sudden fashion, I think I think that was quite shocking. And so the reaction where, you know, thousands of people went to protest at airports, and we saw many, many lawyers give up their time to come out and try to help some of these immigrants and migrants to sort of work through this system. I think that's a natural reaction, and I hope that there's more and more and more protest on these issues. I think one of the key things that has been pointed out quite a number of times is that these bans, there's a few things, I think. Number one, that these bans only target certain Muslim countries.
Absolutely.
that are not, for lack of a better phrase, terrorist sort of training grounds.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, they have that wonderful chart that shows the people involved in 9/11 attacks, people, and you can see that there's not a single country that overlaps. So a lot of people in the 9/11 attacks were from Egypt and Saudi Arabia. I dare say they were all from those two countries. Those two are not on this list.
So it puts paid to the idea that this is about actually protecting America from such extremists. And even if that was the case, that there was a travel ban on such countries, it's still a completely what seems like illegal, unconstitutional, and definitely unethical provision to put in place. And another thing I think that's been pointed out quite a few times, which I've found quite distressing to witness, is that this travel ban affects not just first-time visitors to America. It affects people who've gone through the system legally, who've been vetted, who've had, and for anyone who's got an American green card or an American visa from a country that America can be quite critical of, knows how demanding some of these processes are and how much scrutiny you get subjected to, you and your family and anyone you know.
Absolutely.
And so people go through this whole process, and a very arduous and taxing process, to become permanent residents in America and get green cards. And this is how they're now treated. These are people who've gone through the system legally. When all Trump is talking about is, he keeps on sort of saying that, you know, this is about illegals and about terrorists. I don't think it's about that at all. It's about discriminating against an other that many Americans, and particularly Trump and his supporters, vilify and essentially hate because they're different from them, and that's where they've placed their fears. And so what they've done is just completely decided to discriminate against a whole group of people.
Yeah.
And for these lawyers, for other protesters to come out and react in the way they did, I think that's only just, and I think they should continue to do that, because What is this executive order particularly, but even Trump's election, and a lot of support for Trump and a lot of crap that's being said on social media right now, suggests that the founding principles of what, you know, people say about America and its democracy are actually a lie. And they've always been criticized for being hypocrites on these fronts and discriminating against minorities. Some say warmongering.
Yeah.
And now I think if people that disagree with the stance of the likes of Trump, if they don't disagree with the stance of the likes of Trump, I think America and America's government and society will just push completely right and become its own global extremists in a way.
I mean, absolutely. I think the relationship between the executive and the judiciary is going to be really interesting. We've already seen a judge from one state, which I can't remember right now, I can pull that up, who simply looked at it and said, no, absolutely not. This is unconstitutional. And, you know, at least as far as the certain states were concerned, if you're here, you're welcome here. The attorney general, seconded that and agreed. And we was talking this morning that, you know, she was, you know, promptly let go. So already we're seeing, as you've mentioned, what happens when people push back, when people with power push back, especially the judiciary. And these are questions we've had, you know, here at home, where we had the issues between the public protector and the president, where you become adversaries. Sure, there's supposed to be a healthy tension between the different arms of government, sure. But it's another thing if you don't agree with me, if it's within my power, I will fire you. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be, you know, absolutely fascinating to see. I think the one thing I like that's falling away is this idea that, you know, Trump is not to be taken seriously. Because we saw during the election, a lot of people's, like, you know, he's just saying things. He's just tapping into public sentiment. I think it's officially clear that, you know, Donald Trump is not just saying things. And
I think with this, the executive orders he's initiated in his first week as well, it puts paid to the idea that, you know, there was this sort of, some people had this hopeful idea that once Donald Trump enters the White House, he's going to temper his sort of extremist
that he'd face all these obstacles. And
that's
say,
right. He'll have advisors. He'll have too much red tape and things like that that are going to curtail what he actually can, what sort of promises he actually can meet. But clearly he's shown, number one, that he actually does believe in enforcing these ideas. And number two, he's going to do what he can to do it and sort of screw anyone that stands in his way, as he showed by firing the acting attorney general.
I think another thing that's interesting, I think the lack of, what shall we call it, tact, especially on things like the environmental policy and LGBTIQ rights. And we saw, you know, what I think is an extremely petty thing to do, to remove the environmental policy sort of pages and the LGBTIQ sort of, you know, policy stance from the White House website, and saying that, I mean, it's, for me, that what surprises me, there's just a lack of tact.
I think that happened within hours of his inauguration.
For me, that's just about tact. Like, if I'm sitting here and I think climate change is a lie, and I think it's just made up by the, you know, by liberals to, you know, to kill America, surely I should be tactful enough to know, how do I go about this in a way that has the least scrutiny for me and the least backlash. So why is something as petty as deleting a website page? I just think it's silly.
One thing I think we learned from the election campaign is that Trump seems to thrive on pettiness and backlash. We've seen one of the other big stories outside of the executive orders he's initiated has been Trump and his administration's obsession over this idea that his inauguration
there were
claims and photos that showed that he's at his inauguration there were far fewer people than Obama's first inauguration.
Yeah.
And it seems that Trump has taken this to heart so much that he's extremely driven by these issues. I think he even went to the extent of calling, I think it was the head of national parks in the US, and asking if they could provide photos to counter the media narrative and prove the media wrong and expose them, you know.
I mean,
you see, he's very, very thin-skinned, but then he thrives off pettiness and backlash, and that's at least in the election campaign, that's what he learnt actually propelled his agenda rather than sacrificed it. And I think it's still unclear how it's going to affect him now that he's president. But obviously there are a number of more limitations as president, and people who may have been apathetic during the election campaign now are going to be directly affected by his administration and their orders.
And absolutely. I mean, just looking into this, I mean, a lot of his, you know, orders will have to go through a process. So things like repealing the Affordable Care Act, have to go through the House, have to go through Senate. Simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
This whole thing of building a wall and getting Mexico to pay has to go through the House, has to go to the Senate. Import taxes, same process. So if nothing else, I think there's going to be a real test of definitely the Republican Party, and I think Democrats too, to say, you know, you have certain stances, and Republicans have always said that they're not against legal immigrants.
I think it's going
to
be...
always said that verbally. So now when it's actually going through them and they have to vote, they'll have to be clear.
But I think these divisions within the Republican Party are going to be very interesting, because we've seen Mike Pence... Vice President Mike Pence, in the past, I think it was last year, say he was against any sort of discrimination in terms of immigration of people based on their religion. And he said that on Twitter. It was clear, it was screenshotted. And then after this executive order recently, he deleted that tweet. But clearly he's gone back on his eaten his words and has changed his views to side with Trump. But one of the interesting things that I've seen sort of pan out with you know, Trump's first, you know, what is it? How many weeks is it in office now?
It's a week. It's a week. It's probably now probably 8 days or something. Yeah, we were laughing about it just the other day. Here we are, man.
So,
making Hunger Games jokes. Now look at us now. Yeah.
Excuse me. So, is the international fallout that this will have?
Yeah.
We saw one effect of I think they call it the Mexico...
They call it Mexico City. That's the abortion, the legislation that America cannot provide foreign funding to organizations that provide abortion services.
And so we saw
it's called the Mexico City Agreement, I think. Yeah.
Interestingly, we saw, I think it was Netherlands and Belgium say that we'll sort of pick up that slack and donate money so that these organizations around the world will continue to receive funding. Then with the executive order on this temporary ban of basically certain Muslim countries, I think it's very interesting to note that I think it was yesterday that the Iraqi parliament Iraq's parliament voted to take reciprocal measures in reaction to the US travel ban on citizens from predominantly Muslim countries. And that means that the parliament will now ask the Iraqi government to retaliate by implementing visa restrictions on Americans visiting Iraq, which, you know, we all know America's history with Iraq, but it's very interesting to now see certain other countries potentially retaliating and sort of kicking back to America and having repercussions that could be ill received by Trump's government. Now they're standing up to them.
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen a large protest in the UK, especially around, you know, Prime Minister Theresa May to say, do not meet this person. We've seen Mexico has already cancelled. They were supposed to have their first meeting and Trump dared, you know, the Mexican leader to cancel the meeting on Twitter, and they promptly did cancel it. So I think, how do foreign countries respond to their citizens saying, do not meet with this person, do not deal with this person?
Interesting. Yesterday, so I guess from a South African perspective, ANC Secretary General Guatemantashe was asked about his views on some of Trump's latest executive orders and his tone, I guess, since becoming president. And the Secretary General sort of said that I think he recalled when he was asked previously, what does he think about Trump's nomination? And he said, you guys thought I was crazy, but I told you that America can elect anybody. and that once America even elected a man for two terms just based on his good looks. I'm not sure, but I assume maybe he's talking about Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, must be. I like how that's somehow a win for Guatemantashe. Like, what did I tell you? Yeah. How is that a win for you?
It's right. So
what?
So that's our perspective here. Okay, he said a little bit more.
That's official, in case you're wondering the official response. There you have it.
But it's also going to be interesting to see. Obviously, South Africa has an issue right now with the dumping of U.S. American chickens here through that's sort of basically facilitated by the AGOA Act.
AGOA Act, absolutely.
It could be interesting if the AGOA Act is actually recalled from Trump. I would not be surprised if because it's basically a free trade agreement that gives preference to developing countries.
And his whole thing is we make bad deals. I'm a deal maker.
That's right. And we've already seen his decision to pull out of the Trans-Pacific.
Yeah, Trans-Pacific agreement. Yeah,
that's right. Which is one of Obama's sort of keystone achievements in building relations with Asia. So, you know, it's definitely not out of the question that AGOA might actually soon be scrapped.
Absolutely. If you're just tuning in, we're chatting a bit about, you know, Donald Trump's executive orders. Now we want to turn to things a bit more continental. We've got Simon Anderson on the line. Let's pray to the Skype gods that Skype works. Simon Anderson, can you hear us?
Kingsley, loud and clear.
Wonderful. Thank you. We had some issues with Brooks. Simon, yesterday evening, the AU appointed a new commission chair. Who is Musa Faki Mahamat and what do we know about him?
Well, you know, he really wasn't a front runner for this job. It was really thought that it was going to be a race between Amina Mohamed, the Kenyan foreign minister, and Abdoulaye Bathily, who's a very prominent Senegalese politician and very active in the international circuit. But then sort of unexpectedly out of the shadows came Musa Faki Mahamat. He is a Chadian politician. He was prime minister of Chad, very, very close to Idris Deby, the long-term president / dictator of Chad. He has held lots of prominent positions there, as well as also in the United Nations and in the African Union itself. He was chair of the African Union's Peace and Security Council. Mm-hmm. He was also chair of the UN Security Council when Chad took the rotating chairmanship in December 2015. Mm-hmm. So look, he is a politician with a lot of experience in international organizations. And he should bring that to bear on the African Union. Whether he comes from the sort of ideological background that sort of rights campaigners were hoping for is debatable, given his proximity to Idris Deby, who's a notorious dictator. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
I mean, that's really interesting. You have, I'm just thinking, based on his term on the sort of Peace and Security Council, do you have any idea what his stance might be on things like Al-Shabaab? And we recently saw that attack, which we'll chat about briefly. Do you have any inkling as to what his response might be to things like that?
You know, I'm not too sure about him personally, okay. But certainly the Chadian response to terrorism has been a very security, military-led response. Chad has peacekeepers operating in Mali in the Central African Republic, although they were operating there. I mean, they effectively kick-started that civil war in the Central African Republic. They're also operating in the Niger region against Boko Haram. So I fear that, you know, whereas Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma did make quite a lot of progress in getting the AU to think about conflict as more than just war. And fighting and bullets. You know, she was quite good at saying, hey, there's gender issues here, there's inequality issues. I have a feeling that we're not going to get the same from Mahamat.
And one thing you mentioned, what that might affect this election, just, you know, turning a bit, is there was an Al-Shabaab attack quite recently on an isolated Kenyan base. Can you just tell us a bit about this?
Well, yeah, this is, you know, Al-Shabaab are really very strategic in how they operate. So this time last year, they attacked a Kenyan base in Somalia at El Ade. I mean, independent reports suggest that 147 Kenyan soldiers were killed. This is a huge number. And Kenya was very guilty of covering this up and not really owning up to the extent of the death toll that was caused. A year later, plus minus, you know, just as Kenya was remembering what had happened in El Ade, well, there was another one in the turtle town of Kulbio. And again, we're getting these very conflicting death tolls where Al-Shabaab is saying, no, we killed 50-plus Kenyan soldiers, and Kenya is saying, no, only 9 soldiers died. I'd imagine the Al-Shabaab figure is closer to the truth. That's certainly what independent onlookers in Somalia seem to be suggesting. Now, the timing of this attack was very interesting. It came literally 2 or 3 days before the African Union was voting on its new chair, before Amina Mohamed, who was the favorite, the Kenyan foreign minister, was set to find out her fate. And I wonder if this did have an impact, because it really highlighted how Kenya's role in Somalia is very controversial. And certainly there is suspicion that Kenya is in Somalia for its own interests rather than the interests of the continent or Somalia. And we're not even talking about the interests of Kenya per se, but the interests of the generals and the politicians who are personally involved. You know, a lot of Kenyan soldiers and senior officials have been implicated in a sugar and charcoal smuggling ring in collaboration with Al-Shabaab. You know, they're effectively working with Al-Shabaab to line their own pockets. So these kinds of questions were being asked in the halls of the African Union while Amina Mohamed's candidacy was being discussed. So I doubt that did her any favors. There's also been suggestions or investigations in Kenyan media of massive corruption that Amina Mohamed may or may not have been involved in, which also didn't help.
I mean, Simon, your analysis was fascinating in how you looked at the attack as a sort of strategic act, given the Kenyan presidential election coming up, the AU Commission chair election that we had yesterday, and also a Somalia election coming up. I did not know there was a Somalia election coming up. And your analysis mentions that this is going through parliament and that this specific attack is a way to show that perhaps Somalia is not as progressed on the road to stability as some might hope.
Absolutely. You know, the sort of narrative that the international community and Somalia's federal government would like to sell the world is that, you know, Al-Shabaab are just a minor hassle these days. Yep. They're not a force to be reckoned with. They've been dealt with. AMISOM, you know, have them firmly in their pocket. And Somalia can go ahead and get on with the business of turning itself from a de facto failed state into something meaningful. But this whole process has been riddled with flaws. I mean, the election was supposed to happen last year. It didn't because it couldn't get organized in time. It's not even a real election. I mean, it's just parliamentarians who will be voting for the president. But they can't even appoint the parliamentarians themselves. There's reports of seats in parliament being changing hands for massive bribes. And then you have Al-Shabaab regularly, I mean, this is not a rare occurrence, but regularly making these pretty substantial attacks on AMISOM targets, on Somali army targets, on just civilian targets, places like hotels and restaurants, and really saying, hey, we are still here. We have not yet been dealt with. And I think that this is really going to be a key area to focus on for the incoming African Union chair, because Somalia is really where, you know that whole maximum, that maximum of African solutions for African problems. Somalia is the case study of that. You know, it's an African Union force there. It's all peacekeepers from African countries. It really is being directed by the Peace and Security Council in Addis Ababa. Somalia's success is meant to show that the African Union can take care of continental peacekeeping issues. And if it fails, then we have to ask whether the African Union is really capable of that. And I think that's what Al-Shabaab were doing, is they were just saying, hey, Somalia is not fixed yet. We're still here. And you better keep paying attention to us.
Simon, finally, turning back to, you know, the AU Commission chair, you wrote this wonderful sort of profile last week about, you know, outgoing or former AU Commission chair, Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, who we're quite interested in as a country because of sort of her name being put forward for president. And I just want to talk a bit about that. I mean, your profile starts with, and we'll tweet the link for anyone who wants to read it. Your profile begins with this, with a sense that she was a reluctant AU Commission chair, that she never really wanted the position.
You know, I always got that sense. Even in her first press conference, when it was announced that she would be running, she just sat there. She didn't say anything. And Maiten Koana Mashabana, the foreign relations minister, she's the one who was all excited and said, oh, what a wonderful opportunity this is. And Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, just her face was like stone, really not showing any kind of emotion, definitely not showing any kind of enthusiasm about this. And then when she finally got to Addis Ababa after that bruising election, immediately she surrounded herself with key South African staffers. You know, she brought all her own people in, and she really cut off the rest. You know, she didn't engage with the African Union staff. She didn't engage with ambassadors. She didn't take part much in the social life in Addis Ababa. She basically spent most of her time either, you know, in her office where no one could reach her, at her house in Addis where also no one could reach her, or back home in South Africa, because really that's where her heart was. And I think ultimately that was where her biggest failings as AU chair came in, that she was so unapproachable. She alienated allies. She made it really hard for civil society to have any kind of impact. And that has really tainted her legacy.
I mean, I think to be fair, we also have to take into account, I mean, one, that there was already resentment against South Africa for running and running so aggressively when there's this sort of gentleman's agreement, one might say, that the larger countries, so Nigeria and South Africa, is not supposed to put forward a candidate for this position. And also surely the fact that she's a woman. And whenever we talk about things like likability and approachability and, you know, words like that, it's hard not to feel like it's purely just sexism and people are just not happy reporting to a woman.
Look, I think you're absolutely right. She went into the AU with a whole lot of daunting challenges. And her gender definitely counted against her. There's no denying it. The African Union is an extremely patriarchal place. People were very suspicious of a woman leading the organization, to the extent where in these elections right now, certain countries, particularly from North Africa, were actively going around saying, not another woman. That's the level of patriarchy that still exists within the organization. So she really did have a lot of obstacles. But having said that, I think we do have to, you know, and there's also the structural issues of the African Union. You know, there's only so much that an a commission chairperson can do. Ultimately, it's the member states that make the really big decisions. You know, when Nkosi Zana Dlamini Zuma tried to get hard on Burundi, criticizing Pierre Nkurunziza, she was quickly wrapped over the knuckles at the next AU summit by the heads of state, who said, no, you know, Nkurunziza is one of us, leave him alone. Having said that, I think there are some things we can judge her on based on her actions. And one of the most serious is the way that she cut off civil society from the African Union. You know, in theory, the AU is meant to represent the people of Africa, which means that civil society groups, human rights groups, journalists need to have access to the institution, need to be able to participate going on there. And what Dlamini Zuma did was actively cut out civil society from those debates. She made it almost impossible for NGOs to get meetings with her. She gave almost no interviews to independent journalists. You know, she talked to the SABC and CCTV, the Chinese broadcaster. She certainly would not talk to the Daily Maverick. And she really gave the sense that she was running that commission for the heads of state rather than for the people. And that, I think, was a big mistake.
I mean, that's a great summary. I think the only thing so far that's worth saying is you've mentioned her sort of vision or agenda 2063 for the African Union as really something that perhaps will stay behind and remain as a nice, perhaps, guiding document or visionary document about where Africa's trying to go. Do you think that will be helpful for the Union as a whole going forward?
You know, I hope so. I like to think so. And a lot of people, when I was canvassing opinions about Dlamini Zuma's tenure, raised that as something in her favor. This is the first serious, long-term strategic document that the AU has ever had. And it's not just, you know, broad bullet points, oh, it would be nice to have X and Y. It's really quite concrete details on what to do and how to get there. It's detailed. It's got lots of plans. However, you know, I do worry that it's Agenda 2063 is too closely associated with Dlamini Zuma herself. This was her project, her push to build her legacy. And I worry that whoever comes in afterwards will want to make their own impact and will try and do that by finding another way that's not so tied so closely with it, Dlamini Zuma. That's the one problem. The other problem is the AU actually has plenty of superb policies, really good directions on what to be doing. But the implementation of those plans is always what's lacking.
Okay. We'll just have to keep watching and find out. Simon Allison, thank you so much.
Thanks, Kingsley.
Wonderful. If you're just tuning in, we were just chatting to Simon Allison a bit about what's going on, especially at the African Union. We have the new commission chair, Moussa Faki Mahamat, who's a Chadian diplomat. And basically, what can we expect from him? And I've just tweeted the link to, and we'll put it on the podcast page, also a link to the excellent sort of profile or review of Nkosi Zana Dlamini Zuma's time as AU commission chair. Just going to sort of the last segment for the show, and we want to talk local. Greg Nicholson, last week the ANC NEC had their Lekgotla, and they recently had their sort of press conference to talk about, you know, what did they discuss and what came out of that. So I'm curious of your analysis, especially with this whole view about the next sort of president of the ANC. There's this whole view of what's going on with the Black Ops scandal and whether the ANC crossed the line in their, you know, in their digital campaigning, if we should call it, against opposition parties. And there's just the general view that the ANC is significantly fractured as they've ever been as they elect their new leader. So I'm curious, you know, when you were at the press conference and sat through Gwede Mantashe sort of running through of what came out of that, what were the major things coming out of that Lekgotla?
I think first of all, it's important to preface what was coming into the Lekgotla, what was going on in the news. Yeah. And, you know, our news here moves so fast that it's easy to move past scandal, for the country to be rocked by one scandal one day, and for the next day, there's another scandal that we completely forget.
The cycle is pretty quick.
That's right. So it's so hard to hold on to this stuff. But last week, as I'm sure all of our listeners must know, there was a report by the investigations, the journalism investigations unit, Amabungane,
yep.
Into what the ANC was doing during the municipal elections last year. And essentially what Amabungane found out was that, or there are allegations, that there was a, what was termed a covert or black ops, so sort of communications team, I would say, working in, working in sort of the background with what looks like at least some people in the Tuli House approval, but working separately from them, trying to keep their communication to a minimum. And the this sort of, you know, black ops campaign was, you know, primarily, it seems, focused on what, you know, at best was only only trying to sort of smear the opposition and discredit the opposition and highlight the opposition party's
sort of
faults.
Celebrities and influencers.
That's right.
To sort of be part
And particularly with social media. And at worst, while trumping the ANC, you know, like hyping up the ANC, at worst, what it was doing was sort of leading a, what looks to be at least an unethical smear campaign, and at worst, committing acts of illegal campaigning that would have violated the Electoral Act and Electoral
Code. Yeah, absolutely. Especially that, I think it was the printing of fake posters specifically against the EFF, and, you know, putting pictures of Julius with an AK-47 or whatever. So that, I think that's, if proven, I think that's just blatantly illegal.
That's right. And so one of the key links in this story, I think we still have to find out a lot more, but even on the weekend, more information from Amabungane came out about there were actually recordings of these meetings in terms of planning and finding out what's happening with this sort of covert, I think they called it the war room initially, the team. And so the, one of the key links between what the, whether this team was just a group of sort of rogue supporters led by guys like Shaka Sisulu, he's, you know, a very prominent ANC member, media commentator and activist, or whether they actually had links to the mother body, and this thing was actually sanctioned by the ANC, which means the ANC would have been involved in not, would have actually believed that not only can they not win elections outright without having to do any sort of, use any dodgy tactics, that they actually might have sanctioned something that's illegal. And the key link there is Ignatius Jacobs, who is the general manager of the ANC. I don't think anyone knew who, or most people didn't know who he was, like,
or
last
that,
week.
Or that ANC had a general
manager. That's right. Everyone just thought it was Guede. Like, and that was it.
There. Who's this other guy, Ignatius?
Now, he's, I think he's known around the country.
Welcome to the spotlight, sir.
And he you know, signed off this deal with a woman called Sithle Bolani, who said she did work for the work for this team, and is now suing the ANC to recoup her money. And also, he's heard in this audio recording talking with some of the team members about this sort of stuff, and specifically mentioning how he was trained and knows about sort of espionage.
Oh, this beautiful quote. I'll find it. It's amazing.
Type activities, and the guys running this campaign now don't really know what they're doing. And so in that way, he seems to actually very much sort of suggest that this is what's going on. You found the quote?
Yeah, it's beautiful. It says, "I personally was trained in propaganda, deception, subterfuge, political warfare, and spy works. I know what must be done." It's beautiful.
And the implication for the ANC, I think, is huge for this, because it's also huge for I think, the future of our elections and our democracy, because we always know that political parties are political parties, and they often act, you know, they push the limits.
And elections get dirty.
That's right. They push the limits of what's ethical and what's not, and that's just politics around the world. I think now if they are doing things like waging sort of such huge smear campaigns that actually are quite ugly, when you're actually supposed to be a ruling party with a grand and noble history that says, even though it's got its own challenges, is still fighting to adhere to those values. I think it's very, very worrying if the party is sanctioning and pursuing these issues. And even more so, if the biggest party in the country with the most support, despite its challenges and despite declining support, is actually breaking the law to win elections. And obviously we know all sorts of scandals about corruption and kickbacks and patronage that revolve around election campaigns and all of these allegations of giving food parcels and things like that. If now we're at the level where the ANC or any other party is so willing to break election laws, I think we're in a very, very dire state. So that's what was happening. Actually, those reports are coming out, you know, as the ANC, NEC,
while they were meeting,
right? And so the ANC so far has distanced itself both from its general manager and from guys like Shaka Sisulu and this whole campaign, sort of suggesting that this might have been some sort of unsanctioned rogue unit.
Yeah, like whatever they were doing had nothing to do with
it. Which also seemed to have the backing of the party's, you know, general manager.
With meetings happening at Lutuli House.
That's right. And so I think it's been very disappointing so far that they've distanced themselves from the issue and haven't really come out and commented much on it. So yesterday at the press conference, Guedemantashe said basically that whether they are disciplining Jacobs or not is the ANC's own issue.
Okay.
And like any other employer-employee relationship, the ANC should be able to conduct that you know, within their own processes. I think that analogy is fine, but this isn't a normal employer-employee relationship. It goes back to the heart of our democracy, the values of our leading party, and largely the results of the last election and the future of politics in this country.
Given that there's another election like just about to come out national.
That's right. And so I think at the moment the ANC sort of leadership is in a very difficult space where they may not know what to say or know how to say it, considering how this is all falling out. We don't know.
And if they're finding out, would we find out?
That's the question. Either they actually knew about some of this stuff and are now trying to figure out how to distance themselves from it. Or that they actually...
Not everyone knows.
Yeah, that some guys, you know, the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing. Yeah. And these huge sort of ANC sort of public supporters like Shaka Sisulu are just raising money in their name without the actual leadership of the ANC knowing. And, you know, and then guys like the general manager are backing it without the leadership knowing. Or they're actually involved in it and trying to get out of it. So I think it actually... So Mantashe's, I think, lack of comments on that yesterday and what I think is a pretty weak analogy in trying to just make it seem like any other workplace relations issue, I think raises serious questions over how the ANC is handling this incredible scandal. Okay, so that's okay, Black Ops.
That's Black Ops. It sounds like a video game. I think that is a video game. Was there mention of the leadership race and leadership and what's going on with that? Or was the response just that's internal, that's private?
Well, definitely. I think on a couple of levels. So one thing there was, you know, I think a foreign, I think it was an American journalist or something asked about whether at the ANC there was any discussion of the nominees, who might be the candidates for the December conference when new ANC leads might be elected. And Mantashe rightly said that that's not how we do things in the ANC. We have a timetable. We discuss these things at a certain time. And it all starts with the branch. And branches first have to nominate their preferred leaders. And then a process after that follows. But what was interesting that he did come out of the meeting was this idea and new proposals to try to give more power to ANC branches and avoid interference from ANC regions and ANC provinces. So basically what the ANC is going to do with this conference and the nomination of candidates for leadership is, instead of branches sort of submitting names to regions and then it goes through the regions to the provinces and then, you know, provinces basically...
Then
you,
say yeah, this is what...
That's right.
What is a province.
What's going to happen this time is there'll be sort of like a central point where when branches choose who the candidates they would like to nominate for leadership, that document or whatever it is, or that will be filed
names,
sort of in a central place that goes to an actual national sort of team. And that national team will take care of it, and provinces and regions of the party can sort of be part of the process and overlook how this stuff's coming up. But it'll essentially bypass any potential, or hopefully will bypass any potential, or maybe the most direct influence, direct tampering, for provinces and regions to falsify the actual nominees that branches have submitted. So the idea is that now the party wants to sort of re-inject more power back into its base and core structures, which are branches, and try to just avoid any potential tampering from a higher structure.
Well, that's really interesting, because I thought, I mean, and I love Gwede's quote that said the branch is the primary unit of the ANC structure, which I thought was wonderful and true. But I'm surprised that this was around tampering of the bigger region. I would think it was just more about exerting influence and telling branches, this is how we vote. We are Gauteng, or we are KZN, this is how we vote. Mm. As opposed to just actually tampering and saying, no, all our branches want this person, and that's not true.
I think that's another challenge that likely define these ANC elections. But it's harder then to influence and weaken the powerful's control or I guess influence again over the less powerful. So that is one of the key challenges that the party will struggle to deal with. It's not just that, you know, branches will sit down and look at who may or may not be the best candidate. There'll be influence exerted from pressures higher up, and that often will define who will be nominated and who whole regions and whole provinces will actually end up supporting come December.
Absolutely. And finally, when you were just looking at sort of the meeting summaries, you say that a lot of the things that came up were chatting before the show were actually quite consistent. A lot of the things around municipal governments, around national government governance, a lot of the things are just very consistent, and they're things that the NEC has been discussing for a long time.
Well, there were, I think so this meeting sort of defines some of the key priorities for the party over the year. And I'll run through a few of them if you want. So they were talking about economic growth, accelerated radical socio-economic transformation, land reform, higher education funding, crime, corruption, and building capacity of the state, where they particularly mentioned a few things on municipalities, I think, after reflecting perhaps on some of their losses and challenges since the municipal elections last year. Now, Each of those categories had resolutions that come with it, and you know, many of them were continued sort of goals that have come up before. Some were sort of more current, but I think the real question that a lot of people have is, okay, you know, you're targeting all of these things, which sure are some of the key concerns across the country, and you do have resolutions and aims to, you know, improve these priority areas that are real challenges for South Africa's development. But a lot of people, I think, and onlookers are asking, number one, how committed is the ANC to actually improving these issues while it's fighting this dual problem of factionalism and infighting in a year where new ANC leaders will be elected, and where, by its own account, it's still trying to deal with serious issues of capture and corruption. I don't think there haven't been many people have been focusing on those resolutions. But then I think what's more important from those resolutions, maybe we'll post a link to statement from yesterday so our listeners can check it out. But I think what's more important is sort of what happens next to those resolutions. So soon Cabinet will be meeting for, and the government will be meeting for its own Lekgotla. So they will now discuss those resolutions and will set the government's targets and sort of outline for the year through President Zuma's State of the Nation.
We have State of the Nation address coming up, and the budget speech, and we have that.
That's right. So then we'll be able to see what has filtered through and what will actually be acted on.
Cool, absolutely. I mean, we're chatting before. I mean, Richard Poblack had the interesting article where he mentioned some key things like the national key points, this commitment to sort of protect and defend state infrastructure, and specifically this legislation about wanting to have a border management bill and a border management authority, which in the age of building walls is worrying. So I'm curious as to whether those are just carryovers from previous meetings, and it's just things that are on the agenda, or whether there's actually a real commitment to keep going with this national key point thing of saying Parliament, Kandla, etc. These are national key points, must be protected, cannot protest here. This thing about protecting state infrastructure and this border management thing, especially given Joburg and the issues around foreign nationals and who's actually welcome in the city and city management. And I think that's going to be interesting to watch. Okay. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for tuning in. As mentioned, you can email Greg at dailymaverick.co.za with ideas, things you want us to cover, things you think we should do better, comments, feedback, everything. We love it. Keep downloading the podcast. Please share it far and wide. Thanks for tuning in. See you next week. Same time, same place.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com. Cliffcentral.com.